Can you imagine putting yourself back 2,000 years ago? Jesus is walking along, and he comes up to people, and he literally just taps them on the shoulder, and he invites them to follow him. And these people, without hesitation, drop everything, leave all of their lives behind, and they get up to follow him. Now, every time I read passages like the one that we're going to read now, turn to Mark 1, please. Every time I read passages like this, there's this kind of this obvious question that begs to be answered. And the question is this: why did they do that? I mean, does it ever occur to you when you read what we're about to read, why they would do this? Well, let's look at it. Mark 1. Beginning in verse 16, listen. As Jesus walked beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. "Come, follow me," Jesus said, "and I will make you fishers of men." At once, they left their nets and followed him. And when he had gone a little further, he saw James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John in a boat preparing their nets. And without delay, he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired men and followed him. Look at chapter 2, verses 13 and 14. Once again, Jesus went out beside the lake. A large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. And as he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," Jesus told him, and Levi got up and followed him. That blows my mind. I mean, does it blow you? Does it ever occur to you when you read this kind of passage, what is going on here that would prompt these people to do this? To immediately get up and leave and follow Jesus. We have to put ourselves in their place for a moment. I mean, these are people who have an occupation. They have an identity. They have roots. They have a home. They have some security. I mean, in those days, there was no safety net for people, no social security or unemployment. So if the disciple business did not work out, their whole security was kind of wrapped up in what they were doing. And they had, in some cases, parental obligations, and in the first century culture, you did not take that lightly. Their investment in daily life was heavy, and then someone comes along, taps them on the shoulder, and says, "I want you to leave your life and follow me." Now, let me ask you a question. Is that the kind of decision that you make casually? Can you make a decision like that casually? Because see, I think there would be a very strong compulsion to stay right where you are. To just settle into what you know and what is safe. There's this compulsion to weigh everything on one side of the scale and following Jesus on the other side of the scale. And to me, I have to ask myself, what could be on the other side of that scale that would weigh so heavily that it would balance in favor of leaving? Because everything they had built their life upon said, stay, stay put. Why did they leave? Why did they leave? Well, this text, Mark doesn't mince words, remember. He really doesn't say. I know this. We know that these guys are not just big risk takers. They didn't do it on a dare. I dare you to follow Jesus. I don't think they did it on a dare. I don't think they had bad lives. I don't think they had bad marriages. I don't think they had bad kids. I don't think they had parents who always wanted them to be a disciple, so they were going to do this to please their parents. They weren't sick of fish, and they're not spiritual giants. Why would they leave? Why does the scale tip so heavily to leaving? I think there's only one reason that they would do this, and it all has to do with the person who tapped them on the shoulder. It had everything to do with who tapped them on the shoulder. And, you know, and Mark kind of leaves this out. You know, he doesn't mince words. He just kind of goes straight to the point. But the other Gospels tell us that these men had previous exposure to Jesus. They didn't just meet him in that one instance. They had previous exposure to Jesus. There was something about Jesus, something about the chance to be with him that was so compelling to them that if you stacked it up against their whole lives and you asked them to choose, well, the decision was literally a no-brainer. The decision was leave everything and follow Jesus. So that's kind of the question that we're dealing with. Why follow him? What is so compelling about following Jesus? Remember that they didn't choose to follow Jesus because they were spiritual giants who were far beyond our reach. It wasn't because they longed for spiritual stuff and you and I long for secular stuff. I believe that what's going on here in some very ordinary people, that they saw something with great clarity, and what they saw was Jesus and what he was offering. And I believe when you and I see what Jesus is offering, we would make the same response, because when we really see it, there is no other choice. Now, I believe that it is possible for a human being not to want to follow Jesus, not to take what Jesus is offering. But I think there's a huge problem both inside and outside the church that we don't really understand, and that's this, that we don't really understand what Jesus came to offer. But when you get a real glimpse of how good the good news that Jesus came to give was, when you and I get a glimpse of how good the good news that Jesus came to give is, then our only response that makes sense is to leave everything and go for it. Let me ask you a question. Who do you really want to be like in life? I was watching a news show the other night, and they were talking about people that most Americans or most people in the world would want to be like. And, of course, a lot of people wanted to be like President Obama. And then the second person that came in second to President Obama was some comedian that I didn't even think was funny. And I can't even remember his name. That's how much it just kind of went over my head. The girls wanted to be like Michelle Obama and Lady Gaga. That's who they wanted to be like. That's who they wanted to emulate. When I ask you this question, we're in church. When I ask you this question, who you want to be like, the obvious question is what? Jesus, yeah, because we're in church, right? I mean, that's the answer. I want to be like Jesus. You know, it's kind of like that Sunday school class where the teacher's saying to the little boys, he says, okay, what's brown and furry and hides nuts in the winter? And they all just kind of sat there and looked at the teacher, and he said, okay, come on, you know the answer to this. What's brown and furry and hides nuts in the winter? Nobody would answer, and finally one kid answered, and he said, oh, well, I'm going to tell you know, I'm going to say Jesus, but it sounds like a squirrel to me. See, when you're in church, when you're in church, you want to give the church answer. But I'm not asking for the church answer. Who is it that you really want to be like? Who is it that you really want to emulate? Sometimes we don't really think. We just give the answers. But today I want you to really think. Who do you want to emulate? Who do you want to be like? We're at church, so we say Jesus, but sometimes it sounds so much like celebrities to me. Why is it that millions of people want to be like other people? All these celebrities and famous people, well, it seems like they have everything that we seem to want. Money, fame, adventurous life, they have it, whatever that is. But just for today, lay aside all that cultural side stuff and really think about what will really and truly satisfy your soul. What is really the true foundation from which you want to really build your life? You know what a disciple is? A disciple is someone who has answered the question, who I want to be like. Matthew 24, verse 25 says this, a student is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. See, it is enough for the student to be like his teacher and for the servant to be like his master. And a disciple is someone who says, I want to become like my master or my teacher. And so a disciple of Jesus says that it is my ultimate goal to live life the way Jesus would live life if Jesus were in my place. And these people who got tapped on the shoulder and left everything did it because they were convinced that it was their shot at really living as God intended for them to live. Any other option for them was not an option. And this was not a tortured decision. They didn't go and wring their hands or rack their brain and say, I wonder if I should do this. I wonder, which way should I go, which way? This was not that at all. This was a no-brainer for them. When he tapped them on the shoulder, they immediately got up and left and followed. They were compelled. They understood something or saw something that perhaps we need to revisit in our own lives. What is it that Jesus offers to people that makes it so compelling that you would be willing to leave everything to follow him? I have some observations. Mark doesn't really say it, but I can pull observations out of the text. And here's what I believe. The very first thing is that Jesus offered them truth. He offered them truth. Look at Mark 1, 21 and 22. It says, they went to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, Jesus went into the synagogue and began to teach. And the people were amazed at his teaching because he taught them as one who had authority, not as the teachers of the law. They listened and they understood that he was bringing truth to them, and truth that was brought with authority. His words, the very words that Jesus spoke, could be trusted. Wait, don't just pass over that. He wasn't like the scribes and the other teachers who wanted to be popular. Jesus simply spoke truth. And they were so amazed because they did not live in a world where people spoke truth. They lived in a world of lies and deceit. We read about Levi. Levi was a tax collector. And the life he led was one of cheating and deception. He played the game of trying to get money from people who didn't want to give you money. And corruption in that day was the name of the game. All day long, you would live in a world where there was a continual flow of non-truth. Did you ever hear a fisherman tell a story that was less than 100% accurate? I mean, these guys, they were always bargaining and positioning and manipulating. That was their world. And guess what? It's also our world. Average person lies over 100 times a day in some way. We live in a world where we expect untruth. We expect distortion. We expect manipulation and pressure to flow like a river. But imagine for a moment someone who's coming into your life who never tells you anything but the truth. The sheer truth. In this world of hype and gimmick and pressure and manipulation and deception, imagine having a relationship with someone who would never mislead you and whom you never have to wonder, is that true? Imagine someone who would never mislead you, who would never use language to manipulate you or pressure you. Imagine someone who would never abuse your trust, never play games. Imagine that for a moment. Can you sense the level that kind of trust, that the trust level that would build? To be able to be with a person like that? I mean, do you see the contrast between the way life is lived in our world and Jesus? And then imagine this. Imagine over time learning to become just like Him. Imagine what it would be like if you were an utterly truthful person. Think for a moment, and these are hard thoughts for us, but think of the moments that you have deceived. Some of us have had big deceptions that created huge secrets and enormous guilt, or maybe even just those casual deceptions just to avoid trouble or pain or to spin the truth just to make yourself look good. What did that do? All that did was build a life that lacks trust, even in the deepest relationships. Imagine what it would be like to be free of those deceptions, to be free of that. Imagine being a person for whom lying held no appeal, simply a truth teller. What would it be worth to become somebody like that? And those disciples saw that in Jesus, and it was compelling to them. Here was someone who told the truth, who lived the truth, who embodied the truth. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. Imagine that. When they felt that tap on their shoulder, they were following a man who embodied truth. And not only that, they followed a man who had the power of God. The power of God. Look at Mark 1:23-27. It says this, "Just then a man in their synagogue who was possessed by an evil spirit cried out, 'What do you want from us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God.' 'And be quiet,' said Jesus sternly. 'Come out of him.' And the evil spirit shook the man violently and came out of him with a shriek. And the people were so amazed that they asked each other, 'What is this? A new teaching and with authority. He even gives orders to evil spirits and they obey him.' And news spread about him quickly over the whole region of Galilee." Here was someone who tapped them on the shoulder, who had the power of God. And for a moment, just imagine coming into contact with omnipotency. And I'm not talking about just nature's power or physical power or mental power or willpower. Imagine facing a person who is all-powerful, who has at his call the power of God. Now, these men, remember, they were ordinary men, and they knew weakness. They all knew weakness. They knew what it was like to be in a boat in a storm and to feel vulnerable and terrified. They knew how weak they were and how dependent they had become in their own sin and how they were even trapped by it. They knew what it was like to be defeated by the same habits again and again and again and again. But imagine coming into contact with a person who possesses the power of God. And Mark tells story after story after story of how people came to Jesus and they were healed or they were restored and even raised from the dead. See, the power of God had broken through into their world in this man. And Jesus was constantly saying to those who were his disciples, he says, do not be afraid, for the power of God is in contact with you. Now, it didn't mean that all their problems were going to get solved the way they wanted them to get solved or that they got every request that they asked for, but it does mean that they could possibly live life without fear. It does mean when you and I come into the power of God, it does mean that you can be on a boat with a raging storm and you can sleep. It does mean that even death is not strong enough to overcome God's power. To follow Jesus meant being in the hand of God the Omnipotent. And the disciples learned that nothing could separate them from this power and from God's love. And imagine, just imagine being weak and receiving adequate power for living. To say, I can't do this on my own, but by God's power, I can do this. Imagine to have that kind of power infused in you to give you the power to be transformed, to be changed, power to be metamorphosized, power over time become the person that God created you to be. And the men who left everything to follow Jesus, they were amazed and astounded by this. Because to be with Jesus was to experience the mystery and the wonder of God on a daily basis. And imagine living every day with a wonder of what He is going to do today. You live with that kind of wonder? Right now? Do you live with that kind of anticipation of how God is going to do something great today? In you, and through you, and for you? Or do we spend most of our time in a weakened state, feeling powerless to overcome, to make the right choices, to do what is right? These men, they saw an opportunity to be able to experience something that they had never experienced before, the true life-changing power of God. Why didn't they follow Him? He spoke the truth. There was power in who He was. And then the third thing that they saw was that they showed how He lived with righteous compassion. Look at Mark 1, 40 through 41. A man with leprosy came to Him and begged Him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Filled with compassion, Jesus reached out His hand and touched the man. "I am willing," He said, "be clean." And immediately the leprosy left Him and He was cured. It wasn't just the healing that was so remarkable about this. Notice Jesus does two things. He heals him with a touch. He touches him. He didn't have to touch him. He didn't have to touch him. He could have just spoken a word and he would have been healed. He didn't have to touch him. Question in my mind, what comes first, the touching or the healing? Why does He touch him first? Because that's what He does. He touches him first. It's an act of incredible compassion. Because Jesus is willing to touch those who no one else would touch. And the disciples see this. And you know what? It completely shifts their way of thinking. Because religious people in their day would declare this an unclean situation. That they would cry out, "Don't touch, don't touch." They would make these people who were in desperate condition to cry out, "Unclean, unclean, unclean." They would make them remind themselves over and over and over again how desperate they were and how pitiful they were. That was their society. You didn't bother with the people who were laying along the roadside, much less touch them. But Jesus touches them. And these disciples see this. They see in this man, this rabbi, one who is willing to be approached and would touch lives that were not whole. They see God's righteousness as it really exists, without judgmentalism and without pride, without all the human attempts that mar holiness. They saw Jesus' righteous compassion, and that righteous compassion compelled them to be righteous and to be whole in how they treated people. Because they lived in a world of bigotry and hatred and condemnation. They themselves realized that they needed to be touched, and they also saw how they could touch others. See, this man could make them whole inside. And he could make them holy as they lived with others. There would be true holiness. They didn't want to be just fishermen. They wanted to be holy men. Now, I'm going to put a parenthesis here. There are not very many times that in my preparing of a sermon that God stops me. There's a stop right here. There are people in this room who are outwardly trying to look holy, and you're not. You're not. In fact, the very thing that you're doing mars the holiness of God. There's an outside presence that says that you're whole, but inside you are not. But I want to remind you of the righteous compassion of our Savior, who is willing that he first touch you so that you can touch others. He wants to make you whole. He wants to make you a holy man. He wants to make you a holy woman. These men were compelled by Jesus because they saw the grace, the compassion that he had for those who were so broken. He would love to heal you today. And he will touch you. You don't have to stay away. You can come and crawl in the arms of Jesus because he's wide open, ready to receive you. Whoever that is for, hear that word of God to you. The next thing that Jesus gave these men was purpose. Mark 1:17 says, "Come and follow me. I will make you fishers of men." He gave them a commission to be agents of redemption. It's kind of interesting. In Jesus' day, a rabbi would never go and recruit disciples. He would wait for disciples to come to him and sign up with him to say, "Oh, great rabbi, will you let us follow you?" Because it's kind of a status thing to have disciples. But Jesus does not wait for anyone to come to him. He goes and he recruits, and he doesn't go after the promising young rabbinical students of the day. He goes after ordinary outcasts, sinners, if you will. And in the spiritual food chain, literally, you might think he's going after bottom feeders. He goes after people who nobody else has any use for. And Jesus says to them, "I'm going to use you to redeem the universe. I'm going to put you into the most important business of all, saving people." And you know, they didn't, and we don't live in a world that reinforces the eternal significance of our work. Not very often does anyone at your school or at your place of work say to you, "Hey, today you're making an internal contribution to redeem the universe." They don't make those kind of comments. We don't get calls from People Magazine or Time Magazine saying, "We want to put you on the cover because your contributions to life is making cosmic significance." See, in our world, if you don't have lots of wealth or fame or power, you don't have much to amount to. And then if you have all of that, you discover that somebody has more than you do, and somebody always has more than you do. And but imagine for a moment this person who always speaks truth, who says to you, "You are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. You will turn the world upside down with the message of the good news that the kingdom of God is at hand. You are part of my plan to redeem the universe. You're part of the body, the part of his bride. You're the church. And when CEOs and presidents are long gone and dead and their accomplishments are assigned to the ash heaps of history, what you do, what you accomplish through me will live on and be celebrated throughout all of eternity. Because the difference that you make in the life of one person will change so many things." Imagine being a part of something worth dying for. What would you give to hear words like that? To have a life like that? And the last thing that I can pick out of this is that the reason they were so compelled to follow him is because when they were with him, he produced joy. He produces joy. And they lived in a joyless world. In Matthew chapter 13, listen, Jesus kind of gives a hint. He tells two stories about what he's offering. Listen to what he says here. In these parables, he says, "The kingdom of heaven is like. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, and when a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all that he had and bought that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls, and when he found the one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it." At first, you know, you might think as you read these stories, it's about giving up. It's about being more spiritual, more committed. It's about raising the bar. And you may feel like that you can't measure up to all of that. But it's really, when Jesus tells this parable, it's really about something a whole lot more incredible than giving up. It's about finding something so incredible that in your joy, you're willing to give everything to possess it. It's like having Ed McMahon come to your door, or buying a lottery ticket that pays off. What could you do not to possess this? strange things come to my mind, but I'm thinking about a modern parable of Matthew 13. We see it on reruns all the time. Come and listen to a story about a man named Jed. Poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. Then one day he was shooting at some food, and up from the ground came a bubbling crude oil, that is Texas tea. Texas tea. Yeah, some of you, what are you talking about? But remember seeing that shot of him going, I can't believe my luck. This is it. Jesus saying that if you understand what I have to offer, then you'll understand the kind of stories I tell about people who give up everything to follow me. They're not stories of sadness or drudgery or just sacrifice and pain. It's really not like that. It's like a lottery ticket that pays off. It's like discovering oil on your land. The kingdom of God is beyond your wildest dreams. So what would you do to possess it all? Sell it all. Sell everything just to get this. And it's not being noble. It's because it is a joyful, incredible choice. So here's the point. Are you really following Jesus? If I were to ask you to walk over the hill and sit down in a light and write out on a card your true commitment to Christ, would it be a commitment to follow Him without reservation? Would you write down Lord of all? Would you write down none but Jesus? Would you write down only you can satisfy my soul? Would you write down it is worth everything I have? Would you write down that you tell me the truth, your power, your compassion, your joy? Compels me. Do you have an extraordinary story? I remember, and it may sound so trite, but I remember thinking, if I could just hold that girl's hand, my life would be everything. But you and I know that there's nothing in this world, no amount of pretty girls and hands to be held, no amount of money, no amount of stuff, no amount of anything that compares to Jesus. When you really look at it. And some of you are in a place today where you have been saved, but you have never really reciprocated with the call to respond to the call. And what that looks like in your life, I don't know. I do know this, that it requires that everything that you are, everything that you have, everything that you possess, you willingly will give it up to have Jesus. Every sin that has a hold on you, every emotion that you feel that is not of Jesus, every lie that you're trying to, you're willing to give all of that up for Jesus. Every bit of it. And that there is such a deep stirring in your soul every day that you get up that you can't wait until you see what Jesus is going to do, because you follow Him. You get up and you follow Him. You don't follow anything else. You follow Jesus. When you go to work, when you wake up and you begin life with your family, when you walk out in this world, You're not walking by yourself. You are following your Savior. Do you have an extraordinary life? He offers it to you. He's tapping you on the shoulder today.